The views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network. Welcome to Race Treaty. You are tuned in to Race Treaty, airs on the Black Talk Radio Network every Friday night at 9 o'clock. Those who were listening early, I made a mistake. I thought Brother Robin was hosting tonight, but we have a fill-in host for him. He has been a guest on the program, but we have Brother Najee Muid hosting the program tonight. Brother Najee, you want to take over?
Yes, Scotty, thank you so much, and it's so appropriate to play what's going on, because that's the question that we need to answer. Certainly, with this ball of confusion, as the temptation used to say right after that. Tonight, it's my honor to be the host of Race Treaty, which is a show on anti-racist media. Our founder is Robin Benton, who is not with us tonight. And with his request, I'm so happy to be with you to talk about a topic that is so, so very important, which is called state-sponsored terrorism. That is when a government is engaged in terrorism against its own citizenry. And this has been happening from the very beginning of this nation up until this very second. We're going to have a guest. In fact, two guests on tonight. The majority of the program will be a conversation with Reverend Daniel Buffett, who will share with you his research and his work and how he understands this topic. And at the very end of the show, we're going to have someone from Australia who's visiting the United States. And we're going to just have a very brief introduction with him. And we'll have a show with him at some later date and time. Today is September the 18th, 2015, and we're happy to be with you tonight. So, Brother Buford, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, are you there, Brother?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. So, I'm going to make the assumption that I have a very intelligent audience, and I'm going to make the assumption that some have listened to the show before and some have not. And with that, I would ask you the question, why is it important to know and to assert your human rights?
Why is it important to assert your human rights? I'm going to give you there's a short answer, but I'll give you the long answer, okay? Okay, the short answer is because we're human beings. We're more than just citizens of the United States. I'm talking about as African Americans, but then that goes for anybody that's a human being in the United States. They're more than just a citizen. If you're a woman, a disabled person, or any other demographic, you're all of those things, but you're also a human and you're a citizen. So we have rights that are accorded to us as citizens of the United States under the Constitution. But we have human rights that are accorded to us and supposed to be protected by the United Nations human rights treaties that the United States has signed on to. So treaty law, actually, even though they don't want to acknowledge it, actually a treaty law is supposed to be the law of the land. Because, it's it's talked about in the earlier part of the Constitution, et cetera. So we as people of African descent should fight for our human rights, because here in the United States, they've been able to trample on our human rights while they're saying that they're protecting our human rights. An example of that is that you notice in all of these police killings, these extrajudicial killings that they've done of African Americans, many of these cases were investigated by the federal government. And we know that they killed people under 18. We know that they killed an unarmed person. We know that they tortured them before they killed them, or torture was a part of the killing. But yet, even though there is an amendment to the Constitution, the 8th, I believe, which is against cruel and unusual punishment, Mr. Holder and his Justice Department didn't find that the rights had been violated. So obviously the civil rights laws and the federal apparatus and the domestic apparatus is not enough to acknowledge and protect our humanity. We must go to the international level to get some help or some scrutiny before the thing gets out of control completely.
So what you're saying is that even though it's in the Constitution, and even though there are limits that would prohibit federal, state, and local governments to conduct themselves in the fashion where they are murdering their citizens, even though that's on the books, it still happens. So you're saying that there has to be another solution.
Right. There has to be another solution because, see, they're breaking their own laws. They're breaking the laws of the Constitution. That's a U.S. law. But they're also breaking laws like the Torture Victims Protection Act. That's a U.S. law, and they're breaking that and a number of other things. And the reason why they're able to break it is because they do not respect the humanity of black people. It's as simple as that. We're not accorded the same, not only value as human beings, but the same rights as human beings. Just like in Hurricane Katrina, they did not value the people who lived in the Ninth Ward or Treme or these other areas. So since they didn't value them, they didn't bother to draw up an evacuation plan when the place was underwater, where they had evacuation plans that were laid out for everybody else. The same thing is happening here. Because we don't matter, according to the U.S. Police overuse of their authority, because we don't matter, they don't keep statistics on how many of us are killed, and then what happens to the policemen after these killings happen. Because we don't matter, policemen at every level of every law enforcement agency in the United States, whether it's the federal down to a dog catcher, they don't have to do background checks and full disclosure on whether or not they were involved in Nazi clan, paramilitary, racist hate groups before they got involved with the police. So many times what we are seeing, or what I'm seeing in my research is that the race war has already started, and it's being started by racist elements that have infiltrated every single one of the police forces that are in the United States, and they have the luxury of having municipalities do their legal work for them, their police union do their advocacy for them. And even mayors and governors speak up for them when they know that they're wrong. And so then the state-sponsored terrorism aspect of what you were talking about earlier is this. You know, in the United States invaded Afghanistan because of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And they were saying that Afghanistan was given these terrorist groups that were talking about killing the United States and blowing stuff up here, that they were giving them safe harbor, and they're practicing their terror techniques over there, and then they would export that abroad. Well, state-sponsored terrorism, if it's that over there, then what is it when in North Carolina or California or Florida or Michigan you had Klan Nazi paramilitary groups? They're practicing terrorism, and they're practicing the extermination of Mexicans on the border down there in Texas and Arizona and New Mexico, et cetera. What's the difference between Nazis preparing and calling themselves militia, or Klan calling themselves militia, in counties, in states, in congressional districts, and being protected by the laws in addition to these rogue cops. That's state-sponsored terrorism. They're terrorizing our community, and the state is sponsoring them by giving them safe harbor.
So what do you think the solution is from your research that you have done? Is it that you think we could find some kind of solution by going to the world court? What is your plan?
Well, I think we need an exorcism, my brother. we need to exorcise the spirit of racism and militarism from out of the various police agencies that are supposed to be protecting and serving. Years ago, the FBI and the police agencies, they made a deal with the devil by getting in bed with all these racist groups. And now the situation has become such that you can't tell the Klan and the Nazis and these militia groups from the law enforcement agencies that they've infiltrated.
So you studied 100 cases? Is that the bulk of your study at this point?
Say again, please.
I said you studied, I think, 100 cases where you looked at these violations of rights and you intended
to
go
to the court? My sample was that this is 100 cases of unarmed African-American citizens to the age of 1 minute to in their 90s. And this is from 1970 until currently. And I was looking at cases where police did extrajudicial killings, punishment, torture, summary execution on people from our community who were unarmed. By the way, we're also covered by laws. You know how they're always talking about the drug war and then they come into our community dressed up like military people and the SWAT team operations are basically military operations. Well, if our community is a war zone, then an unarmed person in a war zone is called a civilian non-combatant. And when a civilian non-combatant is killed, that's a war crime. And it's a crime against humanity and it's a human rights violation. So our people who are unarmed or non-combatant civilians who are being attacked by these stormtroopers who come in under the guise of the drug war and other things.
So that being the case, do you think there's a place for us to take these charges to the United Nations?
Yes, I do, because right now there's seems to be no place in the United States that we can take it where our rights are really going to be protected. And so, as a minority group, and I don't like calling us a minority group for all that means in terms of significance, but in fact, numerically in the United States, African Americans are a minority group. We're only 13% of the population, while we're 60% of many jails and prisons. And that kind of imbalance, we have to speak out on. So if we don't go to the international community and speak up, then heaven help us. Matter of fact, the international community is already speaking out on. It's interesting that the U.S. press has not covered the fact that in May, 117 countries lined up in United Nations meetings to condemn the United States treatment of black people at the hands of their law enforcement agencies. Matter of fact, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights last year, with respect to the protests in Ferguson, said, quote, "I condemn the excessive use of force by the police in Ferguson and call for the right of protest to be respected. These things are familiar to me, and privately I was thinking that there are many parts of the United States where apartheid is flourishing." This comes from the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay, on the police response to Ferguson protests. So the whole world is watching, and what the black community must do is, because we've been watching this stuff that we've been saying all along, but now there's cell phones and cameras and police cams and videotapes going on that we can now prove these things. I don't know if you've noticed over the past few weeks, really, the past few years, but let's just say over the past few weeks, you notice how there seems to be an escalation of police just walking up to somebody, minding their business, and then they get taken down. They did that with the brother in New York, who was standing there waiting on a limousine because he's one of the top tennis players in the world. And then they took down Mr. Blake, and like he was some kind of common thug or criminal. And then in Alabama, around Huntsville, here is an older Indian man, a grandfather who was only here for 2 weeks. He's walking around in a white community where his son obviously has enough money to pay for him to live there. But since the cops saw dark skin, read into that black skin, he threw this old man down and broke his neck and other injuries this guy suffered. Or with the young boy who built the clock down in Texas, and you see what they did with him. This is the treatment that black people have had from the beginning. So you take a brilliant young man like that young brother who made the clock. How many times have black people had their creativity and their intellectual acumen and their genius dampened by closed-minded teachers like that? You think about Malcolm X being told that he should be a carpenter and not thinking about being a lawyer or a teacher. These things that happen to black people happen to everybody. And what happens to us, just like Haile Selassie said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So if we don't speak out on these things, then when servicemen are deployed at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, they're going to torture people in Iraq and in Cuba the same way that they were torturing us in San Quentin or Pelican Bay or the Louisiana jails like Parchman Penitentiary and so on. So then what happens to us eventually happens to other people, and we must speak up.
Okay. Now, I didn't get a chance to read it. I got an email today where the United States responded to similar charges that was made against them because they are signatures to CERD, the Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. Are you familiar with what those charges were, and are you familiar with what the United States response has been?
I don't know what the particular document is that you're referring to. What is that?
Yeah, it's called CERD.
The treaty to end all forms of racial discrimination. Well, you know, what's interesting about the CERD treaty review, and actually I was alluding to that earlier when I said I was talking about the nations, the 117 nations speaking out. That was back in May. That's part of the CERD treaty review, which actually had begun last year. But because the United States' hands are so bloody with respect to police misconduct in the black community, they held over comment until this year, and they're still taking comment on the situation of police militarism and racism against black people up until October of this year.
I'm not in the best place in terms of the broadcast, so I need to know from engineer if the background noise is distracting. I'm not sure how.
No, I'm not hearing any background noise.
Okay, my apologies if it does happen. That's a good thing to know. Thank you. So the United States waited to give them the response this year.
Every year, United States, there's three ratified, if I could just say it for a moment, there's three ratified treaties. Ratified meaning that the Senate has signed on, has ratified and approved by a majority of the states that a treaty can go into force. Now, many treaties the United States has signed, like the Treaty on the Rights of the Child, but they have not ratified it. The United States, by the way, is the only country in the world that hasn't ratified the rights of the child, which is interesting with all the pronouncement about child pornography and also with all of the extrajudicial killings of children under 18 that are human rights violations. You're not supposed to administer capital punishment to some person under 18. That's international law, but in the United States, a standard operating procedure is to blow away a young black child, and they don't care if they're 18 or 80.
So in your 100 cases that you cite, in that body of research, there are cases such as that, where people have actually been, children under 18 have actually been executed by the state?
Yes, sir, they have. And out of that 100 cases, let's say there's about, there's at least 25, and actually more if I counted other cases, but there's at least 25 separate and distinct cases where one could say, you know, these are straight up treaty violations, violations of human rights, et cetera. And so these are the types of things that I'm trying to chronicle. Like, for instance, when you talk about the rights of the child, you know, children within the rights of the child treaty, it says over and over again that states are supposed to protect children. So a state is not only supposed to not knock you in the head, they're supposed to keep other people from knocking you in the head. And so they're supposed to protect your human rights, and particularly the human rights of children. So then what I discovered was a number of these cases, 100 cases, and then after looking at the 100 cases, I began to see the way that they were breaking down according to age, gender, whether or not a person was physically disabled, et cetera. And then I began to create categories out of those areas that I began to identify.
Okay. If you were to categorize some of the major areas of these violations, would you say there's four or five different categories of violations, or two or three? How would you summarize your research?
Well, actually, there's more. There's a lot more. But I can share with you some of the categories that have come out from my research. And like I say, these cases that I'm looking at, they're not the only 100 cases, but I would say that they're like prototypical cases. These are cases that are examples probably of thousands of other similar cases just like them. And I just identify some of those. So would you like for me to talk about what some of those cases were and what,
yes,
what I think about them?
Yes, please do that.
Okay. I mentioned earlier about the sad case of this child that was died after 1 minute. And the baby only lived 1 minute. His mother was a Sudanese immigrant to the United States. She was pregnant. She had pregnancy complications. She's trying to get to the hospital. The cops stopped her on the way to getting to the hospital. She was bleeding badly, and the woman told them that she thought that she was losing her baby and she needed to get to the hospital. They arbitrarily detained her and denied her medical treatment. Then she miscarried. And then after she miscarried, then they took her to the hospital. And then after taking her to the hospital, they locked her up for a traffic tag violation.
So that was
in Kansas City, Missouri, in 2009. That's arbitrary detention, extrajudicial punishment, torture, extrajudicial killing. All of those are there. Of course, we knew about Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old who was shot holding a toy gun in a playground in Cleveland. He was shot from a moving car by a Cleveland police officer. This occurred in Ohio, a state that is an open carry state, which permissive state, which means that people can openly display firearms with or without a permit. And here's a situation where white people in the suburbs can walk around carrying guns, but a black child with a toy in a playground is seen as a criminal. And they shoot him. And it's interesting that the mayor of Cleveland, after this murder happened, he went into the city police locker rooms in Cleveland, and he found that they were infested with white white power graffiti from white supremacist groups that were a part of his own police department. Okay, so you have that case, or then you have a case like the case of James Brissette, who was 17 years old, who was shot and killed while trying to escape from New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. 17 years old, obeying a lawful order to evacuate the city, and then they killed him that way. Or you got Dion Flood of New York, who in 2013 was tortured, a victim of extrajudicial punishment, extrajudicial killing. He was beaten. Then the cops put him on in front of the subway train to say that he had been hit by that, but he lived through all of those injuries, but was disabled. And before he died, he told his mother exactly what happened and how they had basically maimed him and beat him before anything involving a subway train occurred to him. And so then there's all of these cases. Kamani Gray, a 16-year-old in New York who was killed by the cops, or Remarley Graham, who was in New York, who was killed in front of his 6-year-old brother, mother, and grandmother as they were assaulted by the cops. You have Alan Bluford from here in Oakland, who was a victim of extrajudicial killing and punishment and semi-execution. Another unarmed young man, and as he bled to death, they just let him bleed to death without getting medical attention. That's torture. That's against the Geneva Convention. You know, even on a battlefield, when you kill the enemy, you're supposed to patch him up. But here, we're not even afforded the rights of enemies on foreign battlefields, because they just kill our kids. They don't, or they shoot us, and then if we're bleeding, then they don't do anything about it. Now, let me digress a little bit. There was a one case that I found. I forget where it was, but here a brother, unarmed, the cop shot him, and he was trying to fight off a dog with his pocket knife. I think this guy was mentally disabled, and then they inadvertently shot the dog, and then they shot the brother and the dog. They brought in the helicopter to medevac the dog out. They gave the dog medical treatment while the black man lay on the steps dying and bleeding to death of his bullet wounds, because they did not respect his humanity and his life did not matter. So then you got Ayanna Stanley Jones, age 7, who was shot by a police officer who was part of a special response SWAT team that raided her apartment complex where she was staying with her grandmother, and the officer was in charge with involuntary manslaughter, and his trials and mistrials. And, you know, so how can you go in to a house with a film crew from A&E behind you filming the episode of the first 48, and then the cop shoots a grenade into the girl's home, it catches her blanket on fire, and then the first cop through the door shot this little girl dead. And so then Mother Jones, they had an expose on an article in the 2010 issue called What Happened to Ayanna Stanley Jones. So then we have case after case like that with our young people from the age of 1 minute up to the age of 18 that were, they were unarmed. They weren't doing anything to anybody other than being black and being young, many of them being young, gifted and black. And they have to suffer capital punishment just because of the skin that they were in.
To hear the range of violations and the circumstances, it sounds almost unbelievable. But of course, we know these are facts. These are the tragedies of living in a lawless land, and tragedies of living in a racist land, because we both know that, you look in their skin, it's part of the racist system that we're living in.
You are
tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
This is Onaji Marie.
Hello?
On Treaty.
Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah, this is Onaji Maweed, on Race Treaty with, our guest, Reverend Daniel Buford, who is giving us an account, of some tragedies, which is just really the tip of the iceberg, because all the cases that he has studied and still gathering, is just sampling of what has been the treatment of people of African descent here in the country called the United States of America, violating every human rights treaty that they have signed and ratified, and violating all the other treaties that they haven't signed nor ratified, but still nonetheless violating those basic human rights. And now we're at a point where we are saying no more, enough is enough. And we're saying that it has to be an end to this. Reverend Buford had intimated that the race war has already begun, in that you have races who have infiltrated local, state, and federal police forces. And in that violation, in their entree to these places, they are using state power or state apparatus that, in fact, therefore, is state terrorism. Where now state institutions, federal, state, and local institutions are being used as they have always been used. This is not anything new. It's just exaggerated. And the cases that he's laid out before us is enough to make anyone sick.
That's right.
And made me and the listening audience as well. So, Reverend Buford, I need to ask you, where do we go from here?
Well, you just quoted the title of Dr. King's last book, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? Well, I hope we're headed toward community, because if we continue on the path that we're on, we're headed toward chaos. And we really need for people to understand what their human rights are and their humanity. It might seem like a little thing, but it's not a little thing when you see how much is at stake when they violate your human rights. And so if our human rights weren't so valuable, they wouldn't be doing so much to keep us from them. So we must protect them. And so then that means that we have to exhaust all means, both domestically and internationally, to bring these cases to the attention of the world. Now, a very wise man, older than me, I'm in my 60s, and so he's 20-something years older than me, and so he has a right to be skeptical. When I told him about what I was trying to do with regard to bringing human rights violations against black people to the United Nations, he asked me a provocative question. He wanted to know, well, what are they going to do? And what will they do? And what good is that going to do? And this is a man whose pessimism is born of the fact that he's a brother who's been around for over 80 years, and he's seen how things go. And so I said, sir, I don't know what they're going to do, but I know one thing, that I hear our brothers and sisters' blood crying from the earth, and all of these cases have been swept under the rug and settled and seem to be forgotten about. And we as black people should never, ever, ever let anybody forget what has happened to us or what is happening to us. And we should cry aloud and spare not. And so I'm willing to stand up before the UN, even if I was like Don Quixote fighting a windmill on this thing. I'm willing to stand up in front of that windmill and say, if the United States is sponsoring racially motivated state-sponsored terrorism against people of African descent. And Exhibit A is 100 cases of unarmed people that have been killed or tortured or maimed in the hands of cops that I've uncovered over the last 45 years. We have to speak up. So whether they do anything or not, we got to do something about it. And maybe nobody else has done anything because we haven't done enough. We've been so busy trying to be good American citizens that we forgot what it means to be good Christians and good human beings. And we need to recover that mantle and recover the authority of what it means to be Christian and human being. Now, I'm not saying that to the exclusion of Muslims or anybody else, but I am saying this, is that in this country that prides itself on supposed to being a Judeo-Christian country, that it should rise to the level of the ethics of the Judeo-Christian scripture and protect children, protect women, protect elders. And these are all unarmed parts of our community that have been killed in these particular killings. Like, for instance, you have the situation where Eleanor Bumpers in New York, you know, this woman was 66 years old, they busted into her house because they were going to evict her, and then they when they busted into her house with shotguns and stuff, she had a kitchen knife in her hand, and then they shot this lady dead. Or Kenneth Chamberlain in New York, who here this brother, his life alert thing went off accidentally. 68 years old, he had heart trouble and other physical ailments, high blood pressure, etc. He calls the life alert people and the 911 people to say, look, there's a false alarm. I just rolled over on him and went off. The cops come to his house, demand him to come in. He tells them that everything is okay and that he's all right. The cops call him and they bust down his door, taser the man, and shoot him dead. This is a man who had been a Marine veteran and as well as 20 years working for the penal institution there. So you have these kind of cases of, like Katherine Johnson, who was 92 years old in Georgia, and they once again, they busted into the woman's house on a no-knock warrant. This sister was prepared, though. She fired a shot over the head of the intruder, and they fired 39 shots back at her, hitting her 5 or 6 times. And the police bullets injured one another, and as she bled to death, they start figuring out how to plant marijuana there to get their story together to justify the fact that they had raided this place wrong. So they handcuffed her as she was dying, and she was pronounced dead at the scene. So we have these cases like Alberta Spruill, who they busted into her house. She's 57 years old, and she died of a heart attack in 2005 in New York. Or Carlos Alces, another brother who, when they busted into his house, mistaken identity, et cetera, he died of a heart attack. So we have those kind of cases, which aren't your boys in the hood looking like they're about to do something, or rob a bank or steal a car type of thing. These are elderly people sitting in their home, minding their own business, and then the cops bust in, playing like they are back in Afghanistan, in Iraq, or somewhere else. And they treat our people like they're worse than the enemy. Because at least under the Geneva Convention, you're supposed to take prisoners, but they're not even taking prisoners. They're just executing people right on the spot. So we see them doing that not only with children, we see them doing it with our elder people, but we also see them doing it with people who have disabilities. I mean, there's this case just recently where in Minnesota, the cops rushed up on this brother who was autistic, and he had on headphones, and he's standing there after he got off his job at the state fair to catch a subway. Cop came up to him and busted him down the way they did James Blake and that Indian gentleman I was telling you about, slammed him on his face, busted him up, made him go into seizures. He lived, but he got all of these marks on him. And then here the cops are able to do this to people. And then there's different ways that, you know, we usually hear about cops in the kill somebody, it's either by shooting or beating, right? That's what you usually hear about. We don't hear about the people who are electrocuted to death by taser, or the people who they do this thing they call dogpiling. Well, they a lot of our people die from asphyxiation and chest compression because the cop will lay on top of you, and they'll get a whole bunch of cops to lay down on top of you as if they're trying to control your movement. But actually what they're doing is they're literally taking your breath away. They'll hold their hand over your face, and then the rest of them pile on you, and as their hand is over your face and your lungs can't expand because you've got all this weight on top of you, you die of chest compression asphyxia. They kill people in mental institutions that way, as well as out on the street. And actually they tried it with this 17-year-old boy who was autistic, and the cop even laid on him trying to keep him from breathing, and didn't work. So, you know, they're torturing us. There's a case, man, I found where a man was in a mental institution and he defecated on himself in the cell, and to punish him, they put him in scalding hot water for 2 hours, and it burned him so bad that they had to scrub his skin off of the floor. Now I don't care what nobody said, that's cruel and unusual punishment, all those things. Matter of fact, cruel and unusual, anytime you kill a child under 18, Supreme Court has said that any killing of a child under 18 is cruel and unusual punishment. Best known whether or not you torture them or not.
So, Reverend Buford, what could the listening audience do to support your work and this drive to have these charges levied against this government? What can this listening audience do to support you?
Well, I think that if you have asked, you know, it's kind of blurred coming through the speaker phone here. Say that again, please.
Yes. How can this listening audience assist you in the work that you're doing?
Okay. Well, they can assist this way, is that, unfortunately, we know that the cases that I've studied on and the cases that have happened, those ain't the only cases that are happening or that will happen. We must begin to look at the cases as they come up and run them through the sifter of the language of the international community. For instance, in the human rights language, police misconduct, you know, is, you know, that's in, for instance, in U.S. language, they talk about police misconduct or police brutality or an officer involved shooting. That really doesn't tell you as much as an extrajudicial killing or extrajudicial punishment or summary execution or torture does. Anytime a child is beat up by a cop, that's torture. Anytime that they're tasering you and beating you and then layering on top of you and smothering you, that's torture. Anytime they shoot you and leave you lying, bleeding to death, and not giving you medical attention, that's torture. When you're a pregnant woman and you needed help like Sophia Salva, that was torture. So we need to redefine what's going on to us in the United States, not in civil rights terms, but in human rights terms, which is what the reason why the rest of the world is outraged is because they see the death of our children on the streets as summary executions and extrajudicial killing. Period, you know, and they ain't dancing around police misconduct or discharge of a firearm. They're going right for the gusto and calling it for what it is. That these are people who have been found guilty, and the cop is the judge, jury, and executioner all at the same time.
So that's why they call it extrajudicial charges. That's why they use that term.
Exactly, because it says that it's not just police killing, but it's police killing beyond judicial procedures that are accepted norms, both domestic and international norms.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you know of any cases before the World Court where someone, a group of people like ourselves, being oppressed, being victims of state terror, where they have actually brought charges against a country? And do you know if there ever been a case where they've been successfully tried, or in those states have had to modify their actions.
Yeah, matter of fact, that's happening all the time. I mean, you know, last year there was a whole lot of groups, Amnesty International, they jumped out with a great report, the Organization for Black Struggle. They talked about the U.S. compliance or lack of compliance with the Convention Against Torture. There's a lot of groups that have done this. I mean, you know, there's a shadow report about the human rights perspective on prompting independent investigation of law enforcement misconduct. That's from out of Minnesota. So there's a lot of groups that are filing these reports. I mean, I myself was involved in creating a complaint report regarding Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago and the human rights violations that occurred in the immediate aftermath of that hurricane. That complaint report was presented before the United Nations in New York, and that complaint report, as well as the recommendations that I had within it, were used as a template for when the jurists, the international jurists, began to cross-examine people from the U.S. delegation in Switzerland. They used my report as a template for that cross-examination. And then in the concluding observations, they used some of my recommendations there. So then people didn't know a whole lot about that, but see, there was international pressure on the United States in that case where those cops were found guilty of killing those people in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, with Saddam going over the bridge. Well, the first mention of that as a complaint was when I mentioned it in New York in Geneva, Switzerland. That's before it even became a civil case or a case that began to be litigated and that they even brought it against those cops. So, you know, it was already, so the cat was out of the bag, so to speak. The cat being the CAT Treaty. CAT Treaty is the Convention Against Torture. So that was already out of the bag. They couldn't hide it. And so it's not that, you know, that's a useless exercise. You know, we as people of African descent, we've been told that nobody cares about us. And it's like being in space. Nobody can hear you scream. Nobody cares about you, so you're hollering. We're like abused children that have been told by the abuser in the house that if you say anything when company comes, you're going to get it when they leave. And then we don't say anything. And then we get more of this abusive treatment. And so then we have to speak out. We have to get over this abused treatment and the syndrome of being an abused child and speak up and say not only are our civil rights being violated, but when company comes to the UN, we got to tell them that our human rights are being violated. They know that. They can see it on the TV. They can look at it on the Internet. You know, the United States doesn't even keep statistics on how many black people and other people are killed by the cops. Those statistics are being kept in England.
Wow, isn't that something? So, Reverend Buford, we want to thank you for who you are, your consciousness about humanity, and particularly black humanity. We wanted to encourage you to continue this research, and we will be asking you to come back on the show to give us updates in terms of your progress and still answer for us, not now, but next time, what is it that you want us to do? What do you want the listening audience to do? Because you said, quoting Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, either chaos or community. So we have to build our community so we can support the work that you're doing and the work that other human rights activists are doing so that we can, in fact, enjoy liberty, justice, for all of us. So, I want to thank you so much.
Can I just one more point? And that is that there's a point of reparations. And that is that, all of these abuses have to be, there has to be reparations, remedies, and justice. And I hope that at some point in the near future, we can talk about those remedies and justice. Because, you know, we got a lot of people talking about reparations for slavery, and that's going back before the time of 1865. And that's a number that no man can number right now. But we can number how many of us have been lynched and everything since 1865. And how many of us have been the victims of police brutality since the signing of the UN Charter? We ought to use that as the basis for a complaint for reparations, and that's what the UN recognizes, is that kind of thing.
Reverend Buford, before you go, this Scotty just want to make a quick point. Reparations for slavery that's going on right now, because the 13th Amendment only amended slavery as punishment for crime. That's a different
right.
definition than abolishing it. And so today, you know, Bernie Sanders, and I'm not endorsing, I don't endorse politicians, but he introduced a bill to abolish private prisons and jails. So I said the same thing to the reparations community. Y'all talking about something that happened hundreds of years ago. Well, guess what? Slavery was never abolished. So, you know, it's still ongoing.
That's right. As a matter of fact, they've really, with all due respect to the great work that the reparations committee has done, they haven't asked my opinion, but I'm going to give it to them. What they need to do is back up a little bit. What they need to look at is what are the human rights violations that have happened in the last 150 years? That's a number that's a finite, countable, and measurable, and knowable number. And they should use that as the basis for arguing for reparations, the same way that the Japanese argued for reparations and many other countries, Native Americans have argued for reparations in Canada, and were able to be successful because they actually had the numbers. We don't know what the numbers are from slavery, but from 150 years ago, we know. From 70 years ago, we know. We ought to use that as the basis and then say, now that we got your attention on that, now you ought to pay us back for slavery. We're going to look at
not only abuses here in America, but throughout the world where people of color have been oppressed and harmed. And I was hoping that we would listen to, introduce to the audience, A.J. Williams from Australia.
I believe we have him on the line. We just had...
Aboriginal brother from Australia that's visiting the United States of America for a week with his family, and we'd like him to say a few words, and I would say to the listening audience, we hope to interview him and play that tape at a later date. Brother Williams, are you on the line?
Hey, how are you?
Very good. So tell us a little bit of who you are and why are you here in the United States, and why did you want to get in touch with some of the African social workers of African descent?
Oh, well, my name's A.J. Williams. I'm a master qualified social worker from Australia. I'm visiting my family. I'm in New York, as you can hear it. I work in Aboriginal mental health, and I try to get in contact with I'm just trying to get in contact to make some links to look at the disadvantagement that African American people have had over time and make comparisons with the Australian Aboriginal community.
We want to thank you for that interest and say to you that we're going to hopefully look at Monday as a time, I think it's Jerry, at 11 o'clock. That could be aired at a later date. We're at the end of our show at this point. I want to thank Adrian Williams from Australia being on a call for a brief introduction. I want to thank Reverend Buford for the work that he's doing. And I want to ask our listening audience to stay tuned and come back on, because we're here for you, and we only can do this with your support. Thank you so much. This is Onajin Wee from Race Treaty signing off. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things and what they used to be are oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas. Fish oil, mercury.